There's nothing like sitting back, enjoying the beautiful sounds of the Werribee River. The birds singing to each other, the water finding its way to the bay, wind rustling through those river red gums. But wait, what's that? A picnic lunch of KFC discarded on the banks. A broken kid's toy shoved into a bush. A shopping trolley half submerged. My serenity is retreating. So why do people litter? Well, it's a million-dollar question. And today on Once Upon a River, we're going to try and answer it with the help of environmental psychologist Rob Curno. I'm not sure if he spent $1 million, but he's definitely spent 1 million hours working on campaigns to try and understand and change people's disposal behaviours. He's written a fantastic book called Litterology, co-authored with Karen Speer, in which he shares the insights he's gathered over 20 years of work and research on anti-littering and behaviour change programs. And he'll be sharing some of those insights with us today. You're listening to Once Upon a River, a podcast from the Werribee River Association. We're speaking with environmental psychologist Rob Curno on the show today, and I wanted to begin by asking you about your unique social research method that you use to try and understand the public's disposal behaviours. So let's start with how you got all this incredible data.
So one of the things that we did for our original behavioural research was to look at people's actions and compare it to what they said. So we used a technique called the litter spy. We went to the Sydney Olympic Games and we were using this technology where I had Lisa connected to a two-way radio, and I would send her across to interview somebody who I thought was interesting. And Lisa wouldn't know whether the person had littered, whether they'd used a bin, or whether she was looking bored and I thought I needed her to go and do some work for asking some survey questions. So she'd wander across to Jess if I tried to describe Jess appropriately, and she'd start a conversation. And in the course of the conversation, she'd say to Jess, "Do you like the Sydney Olympic Games?" "Yes, they're the green, environmentally friendly games." "Oh, yes, they are. I'm very pleased to be here. They're setting new standards." And in the course of conversation, we'd slip in some questions about littering behaviour. And Jess, being an older person, would say, "Oh, it's all those teenagers. I've never littered in my life. And, you know, it's those young people that are dreadful and we really need to do something about them." So Lisa would wander back to me at the end of a session and we'd match up our data from what I observed and what she'd recorded from the survey. And a question I always ask at a seminar is, what percent of people that we had just seen litter do you think actually were aware of their behaviour or told us the truth? Now, what's really interesting isn't what the actual number is. I mean, that's a piece of science in itself. But most of the research up until we started doing the litter spy technology was based on what people said they did rather than what they actually did. And what was interesting about that is the millions of dollars that were spent on campaigns to alter or influence behaviour that were measuring self-reports. And most of us, when it comes to something like being environmentally friendly, falsify or aren't completely honest about our behaviour. And so the message for a lot of the people running campaigns is that if you're going to spend your money, you want to target the behaviours that you're actually seeing happening, not what people tell you to do. And so the figure was around 25-30%, can't remember exactly. And that's people who were willing to say, "Yes, I've littered."
I'm interested in the book, rather than saying like littering behavior, you specifically say disposal behavior. What's behind using disposal behavior rather than just littering?
So we had a new member of staff join us, and this is in probably 10 years in, maybe 15 years in. And he said, "So Rob, you're doing all these behavioural observations, fantastic. You've got this lovely database that shows that two-thirds of people do the right thing most of the time in most public places. And I went, yeah, isn't it great? And he goes, well, yeah, but all of your measurements and all of your indicators are about people doing the wrong thing. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, look at how you measure disposal behavior. Your disposal behavior index is telling and identifying negative behavior. And so we then sat back and thought about how to change our own focus, because all of our photos were about people doing things wrong. And yet 2/3 of people were using bins correctly and signage was working in places. So then we developed a set of techniques for measuring positively, and that's where we focused on what people did with their disposal actions rather than simply looking at littering. Mm-hmm. And the idea there being was that there's a good news story to tell and it wasn't getting any airtime. And so Victoria again led the way in focusing on the positive behaviours, the disposal actions, and set targets for increasing the positive rather than decreasing the littering rate.
And I guess that sort of feeds into also what the book really highlights, is that there really isn't like one kind of person that litters. Like, your book doesn't give the answer of this is why people litter, because someone might recycle, you know, their can, and then the next minute shove, like, put their ciggy butt on the ground. So it is really conflicting people's behavior.
And that really started very early on. So we were down in Tasmania and two things happened that really startled us and made us sit back and think, hang on a minute, we really need to pay attention to what people are doing. The first person that I interviewed as a highly trained, you know, psychologist and independent and not subject to any bias, was a guy with dreadlocks and had been coming out from the bush where he'd been living for some time, and he was smoking. And I got sent to interview him. And I said, oh, in amongst the questions, have you ever littered? And he goes, no, I never litter my cigarette butts. I'm really concerned about it, and I'm really meticulous about it. And he could see the disbelief on my face. So he rolled down the cuffs of his trousers, and there were 6 cigarette butts in there that he'd put out and carefully kept until he could find a bin. So it made me sit back and go, we've all got biases about who litters and what kind of person, you know, is a litterer. And yet someone who you go and have your ideas challenged with can really open up your eyes.
That's something that I think is important to look at, especially when developing programs, that you're not developing programs based on a stereotype. When you are designing the program, it's not necessarily looking at the person. It's looking at the behavior. And what is the behavior? And then what is, you know, the options that can deal with that behavior, rather than looking at a person and you bringing those stereotypes in to develop these programs.
Yeah, it's one of the classic ones that we did in New South Wales was with the Lebanese community and with a group of councils working together. And up there where the weather's a little kinder than down here, there's a lot of barbecuing going on. And the traditional way to cook meats and foods is on a char-grilled charcoal barbecue. And the council was complaining that there was a lot of these coals being tipped on the ground and causing fires, and, you know, how dreadful it was, and how it was, you know, this cultural lack of understanding about littering behaviour and, you know, what people should do with it. So we actually went and talked and sat with the community and did quite an extensive study and actually worked with them to design a bin that could take the used coals that were still often alight and that would extinguish them. And we saw people walk 250 metres carrying their barbecue to use these bins and to do the right thing. And it was really that the councils hadn't provided any facilities that a lot of this littering behaviour was occurring, or this disposal behaviour was being very negative. And we went from having a few fires and other things in parks through to people actually using the bins and going out of their way to do the right thing. Typically, the way that we develop programs is someone has a good idea, and usually it'll be someone who has their own particular biases rather than understanding what the actions are. And you see these programs where, oh, we've got to convince the community that, you know, coals are bad and they shouldn't be using them and we should get gas fires. And you go, hang on, do we really understand the significance of the way that people recreate and cook and use the facilities? And if we do, do we really believe that that's they're out there to damage the environment that they go into every weekend to recreate?
Another thing to come out of this book was the fact that environment impacts behaviour. So in a number of different ways. So firstly, clean places often stay clean.
Oh, well, it's one of the truisms. There's very few solid facts in the littering world, but one of them that's true in almost all the cultures I've been into is that clean places are less likely to have people littering in them. And places that are littered are more likely to attract littering behaviour. And that's been verified with our measures for clean spaces and the way in which people behave in those spaces. And it's also been verified worldwide in Western cultures, European cultures, and even up in Singapore, where, you know, the myth is if you use sanctions alone, you can influence behaviour. And they've moved much more to trying to understand people's behaviour in context in recent years, because there's sort of rules that people have about how they behave in different places.
I was a bit dismayed by the fact that shopping carts signify disorder, because we have a bit of a shopping cart issue in Wyndham.
And they have the added advantage, of course, is that they become pseudo bins, because you can throw your rubbish into it and it's contained.
Yeah.
And that attracts more rubbish into the shopping carts.
Mm.
And it's been a bugbear for many, 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 many years and still not really solved. The big message in the last 15 years of research for us was that how, I guess it's local government mostly, present a place directly influences how people behave. And, you know, the whole idea that people will be responsible no matter what you provide them with, if you tell them to be responsible, doesn't work. You really have to look at what are the disposal options that you provide for people as to go with the education campaigns and the facilities that you present. And if you leave shopping carts littered around the place, under graffiti, with trash in them rotting, then the clear message is you don't care about that public place. And if that's true for the managers of the place, then it's likely to then influence the behaviour of the people using it.
A word I liked that you use a lot is binfrastructure. So obviously the bin infrastructure of a place, that has huge impacts on, yeah, people's disposal behaviour.
So binfrastructure is our only attempt ever to do marketing, and it's kind of caught on for a little while but didn't really last. But the idea is that if you have a look at the way in which public places are presented, it's not just the bins, it's the whole infrastructure that goes with it. So our assessment techniques take a total view of a place rather than just looking at the bins. And yes, we assess the bins very carefully and very consistently, but we also assess the other infrastructure features, because how your furniture is presented, how your landscaping is presented, how that public place actually appears to people has a huge impact on their behaviour.
You're listening to Once Upon a River, a podcast from the Werribee River Association.
You know, we do run a number of litter groups. There is value in that restoration of place. You know, there is the removal of litter, but then also the broader impact that that has on restoring place.
And what we know is that restorative practices where you engage the community, the ones that are using the space, rather than simply doing it for them, as it becomes more of a partnership, then you actually get a much better longevity from it. So whether it's looking at how you manage graffiti, or whether how you manage skate parks, or how you go about taking an area, you don't simply just clean it up. You have to look at the way in which it's being used and how the people using it value it and what they want to do in partnership with the people that manage that. And that's often more difficult for local government because the answer for many people in local government is just put in more bins or go and clean it up and, you know, it'll be fine. And, of course, it won't stay clean unless you do other things to value or restore that place.
And that kind of feeds into this idea of a sense of community. What is a sense of community? What is that? How do you build it up? And how does that impact on an area in terms of reducing littering?
One of the things that stood out to us was, again, very early days were in Tasmania, and there were a couple there from Singapore, and both were smoking. And the first guy, the male, had his cigarette and he wandered over to the bin and he very meticulously and carefully put it out and put it into the bin. His partner finished her cigarette and just threw it on the ground. And we interviewed them both and he said that he had a strong sense of involvement and community and commitment wherever he went, and that that was his commitment to being part of the broader community or populace. She said, oh, I got a really strong sense of community in Singapore, but this is Australia, so who cares? And so the way in which people value the sense of place comes back to what we call this social compact. And it's the rules that people have in their heads for when it's okay to litter. There's a full and overflowing bin outside of your meeting room. You've finished your sandwiches or beverages or whatever you've got, and you want to dispose of the material that you've got there. What do you do in relation to that full and overflowing bin? Is it okay to leave your rubbish next to the bin? When you hear yourself say, it depends, that's your own social compact rules coming into action. And one of my colleagues in New South Wales says that, oh, everybody litters at some stage or other because it depends on the environment they find. In some environments, they're just going to chuck stuff out into. So it's a fairly well understood phenomenon, but not everybody uses it to design their campaigns.
Something I was thinking about in terms of how a sense of community really impacts on people's disposal behaviour is we've got a pretty notorious strip of road called Balan Roads. You all know what I'm talking about. Werribee to Bacchus Marsh, if you drive that, it's where people go to dump rubbish. There's nothing there. There's probably some housing estates that will be or are in the stage of getting built, but it's a bit of a no man's land. There really is no sense of community. There's no love for that strip. And how I know there's like Adopt a Highway and those sorts of campaigns to try and bring love to these strips of road that don't, you know, it's not a public park where you go and walk your dog or hang out with your kids. Yeah, doesn't have that community attached to it, and how difficult that can be when addressing those areas.
Yeah, and the same, we call them transition point places or points. So you often can see that in laneways and things from a pedestrian point of view. If we take a look at what happens with illegal dumping, and some people talk about a continuum from littering through to illegal dumping and the behaviours that are there. And the thing that differentiates illegal dumping is a complete and deliberate disregard for social mores and the sense of community. And so on that strip of road, you've got people that are anonymous in their cars that are deliberately going out to dump. And I'm not talking about littering from throwing from vehicles here. I'm talking about people that load up trailers or whatever and try to do the hidden behaviours. And the problem with that, of course, is that it then becomes a target for future dumping because that's where you take your stuff to be dumped. And it can often be the place where some people will deliberately litter because they know it's going to be cleaned up. Illegal dumping is really tricky, and that's where your use of sanctions and enforcement's important, but you can't just use that. If the side of that road is dirty, unkept, broken up, if it's seen as being ignored by the RTA or the transport people as well as council, then it says, oh, we really don't care about this space. You can't just put up a sign and leave it at that.
In regards to signs, they can be effective though. There are ways that they work. I know you talked about one where it had eyes on it, so people felt like they were being watched, and so they did the right thing. You know, it's often see people, oh, just put some more signs up. Is that, is it, is, does it work?
Oh, well, it's what's classic about the eyes is that they're not necessarily signs. They're just a pair of things that kind of look like eyes. And if you put them in inappropriate places, that set of rules that people have, the social compact, it depends. So will you leave your rubbish next to a full and overflowing bin? Not if there's a pair of eyes looking at you, because you say, oh, they're being observed, or that sense of guilt, or that situation is triggering this other process that's going on in your head. So, yeah, signage works, but it has to be targeted and has to be appropriate. So signage is really helpful. Signage at the point of disposal, if you're trying to do a WasteWise event, out with your communication, on the entrance, reminders in there and at the point of disposal in order to have an effective waste minimization kind of event.
Social norms, of course, are a massive dictator of what we do and don't do. You know, during the drought, the Target 155, if you saw your neighbor watering the garden and it wasn't their day to water the garden, boy, you know, you'd get the stare. So how do we sort of work with social norms, and maybe the eyes are an example of that, to, yeah, help, I guess, reduce people littering?
How many dog owners have we got in the room? How do you feel when you don't pick up your dog poo and people are looking at you? If you want to know the impact of peer pressure or of social norms, that's it in a nutshell. And what's really interesting in looking at dog poo collection behaviour as opposed to leaving it littered is that it wasn't government that started a campaign. It wasn't because of the nutrients getting into the waterways. It wasn't because people were appalled by standing on it. It was this sense of community. And as dog owners, you obviously talk to other dog owners, and if someone needs a poo bag, you give it to them. And often that behavior is supporting people to do the right thing rather than ostracizing them.
So, you know, I'm talking about the land road again. There is a social norm that that's where you dump your rubbish. How do you go about shifting that to make it, no, that's not acceptable?
One of the things that we did a program again in New South Wales working with people who are what they call RID officers, and they spend their time chasing people that are illegal dumping. And I can't remember what the R stands for. But they actually have techniques for guiding people's behaviour so that they illegally dump in front of cameras, and then they find them and they follow it through and really apply the sanctions. And the thing that's going to happen to change illegal dumping behaviour that it requires is government and councils to follow through on the fining. So they say penalties apply, but often they don't have a consistent approach to using fines to get the people who are deliberately dumping stuff illegally. On top of that, then you've got a whole range of motivations for people who are moving home, who don't know how to use the services for collection. They're not communicated with from councils in terms of what you do with the stuff when you're moving out. And so there's a lot of programs, again, in New South Wales we worked on, where you actually have an outreach program to the community so that you prevent that crisis of happening where you've got a need to dispose of things immediately and so you just go and dump. And a lot of people don't necessarily want to illegally dump, but they don't know about the other options.
So I do want to butt in now just to highlight that Wyndham City Council have tried to address the issue of tip fees being a reason for rubbish dumping. And they have instigated a great initiative whereby most Wyndham households have three free hard and green waste collection services each financial year. And these can also be exchanged for free tip passes. So if you are moving out of home and you need to get rid of rubbish quickly, there is no need to pop a whole lot of rubbish in your car and dump it somewhere random. You can pop it in your car and drive it to the tip, and be able to exchange one of those hard and green waste collection services that you are allocated per household for a free tip pass.
And there are going to be some what we call willful arrogance, or people who deliberately flaunt the social norms and who deliberately throw your beer bottles or whatever it happens to be out. And that's where you need the consistent campaign of enforcement to go with the community acceptance of working together. Because if you just rely on people working together effectively, that small cohort will undermine the confidence and abilities to deliver. And many councils are reluctant to follow up litter fines and to spend time doing it. And police certainly won't become involved. So you really need, with your education people there in Wyndham, to have your on-site enforcement officers in that area working towards understanding what's going on and then being able to be supported when they actually do go about giving fines.
Yeah, it's not just one straight answer. That's what I think I've got out of this book. It's not one kind of person that litters. It's not kind of one kind of program to address it. There are all of these facets that need to come in. It's your bin infrastructure. It's your sense of community. It's your enforcement. It's your rewards and how you bring all that into a program.
And that's what the research says. And as soon as you hear someone say, I've got a really good idea, this is going to solve the problem, the thing that you what need to do is turn to them and say, what is it based on?
That was Rob Curnow, co-author of Litterology, Understanding Littering and the Secrets to Clean Public Places, a wonderful book that is sadly out of print, but you can download an e-version on Amazon. We also have a community copy at the Werribee River Association that you are able to borrow. So please do get in touch via our website if that's something that you'd like to get your hands on. Stay tuned for more episodes of Once Upon a River, highlighting ways that we can care for and connect with our wonderful waterways.